Welcome to the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. Well, on this week's show, we'll be looking back at the seismic events of 2016. If there's one thing we can all agree on, it's been something of a spectacular year in British politics and indeed the history of the world. I don't think it's even an exaggeration to say that. We'll be looking back on some of those events today. Now, we've done something different for this episode. We've conducted a poll. A poll of listeners to the podcast and also of readers of politicalbetting.com. And there'll be a fair amount of sort of crossover there, I'm sure we'll all agree. And 600 people plus responded, and there's still people responding at the moment. And we asked a series of questions around what people thought the biggest shock of the year was, who people thought the biggest winners and losers might have been, and what the defining moment of the year was too. And we also found some time to ask some controversial questions, such as who the best poster is on politicalbetting.com. And we'll be visiting that thorny issue in the near future. But we wanted to understand kind of what our listeners and readers of the site thought, and get some people's comments as well. So we'll be reading out some of your comments on today's show. But first of all, a real big thanks to everyone for taking the time to fill in the survey. Getting, you know, 600 plus responses in just over 24 hours was really, really great and really sort of touching that everyone took part. So I'm joined today by our sort of fellow podcasters, Leo Barassi of Noise of the Crowd. Leo, welcome.
Hi, Kieran.
And Rob Vance of Penshine Burns, who is currently sipping on a glass of red wine, very much in the Christmas spirit.
Quite right, too.
Quite right, too. Rob, welcome. So, guys, let's go through some of these poll findings as we do. I'll start with the biggest political shock, I should use that caveat, of 2016. And the findings tended to, I mean, I put some sort of what we call pre-codes in there, but just some suggestions for people. And they were the overwhelming favourites. We had the UK voting for Brexit was one of them, Donald Trump winning the US presidency, and then there was also David Cameron standing down, Theresa May becoming Prime Minister, Jeremy Corbyn being elected, or re-elected if you like, as leader of the Labour Party, and then I offered people the chance of something else, and people suggested different things. And I think the pretty much runaway winner with more than 50% of the vote was Donald Trump winning.
Ironic.
Well, yeah, ironic potentially. Was Donald Trump winning the US presidency as the biggest shock of the year. I mean, Rob, what do you think about that? I mean, is that something that you'd agree with?
I'm on the side of our listeners and readers on political betting. I think Trump's victory really was a shock. Whilst obviously it was surprising, and you know, in the run up to the Brexit vote, I was, I think, in line with lots of other people in terms of thinking that, you know, there would be a return to the Remain side of the vote, and that Leave didn't have enough of a margin in the running up week, in the weeks running up to it. But then I think as the results came through, there was a logic to them, and it did make sense. Whereas I think there was more that was surprising, particularly given the polling, I think, in Trump's victory. You know, Leave had the lead several times in the preceding few months. The final polls, whilst they did show a slight swing back to Remain, were still well within, you know, margin of error type stuff. Whereas I think, you know, Trump's margins in Wisconsin and getting, you know, and Pennsylvania, I was, you know, genuinely really surprised by. And as the night wore on, again, there was a logic to them as they started to come through. But the sort of the speed with which, you know, Florida, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, for that matter, you know, were away from Clinton was genuinely surprising and obviously a hugely impactful shock.
I mean, it's funny, I mean, probably a good thing. I would disagree, actually, although, of course, Donald Trump winning was very surprising. I mean, I was, I think, less bullish, if you like, on Hillary Clinton's chances. You know, one of the things I noticed in the polls and the run-up to the result was that Donald Trump was getting 80-85% of the Republican vote, and it felt like there was room for him to grow from that kind of 4 or 5 point lead that Hillary Clinton had in a popular vote. And so it seems that that's what happened, although we still need to dissect what exactly happened. And of course, Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote by a couple of points. For me, I must be honest, my biggest surprise was Brexit, and I completely take your point, actually, on the polling. I think that I was one of these people that was guilty, like many sort of pundits, of buying in too early to this idea that the telephone polls must be somehow more accurate than online polls for the Brexit vote. And I think even people that didn't necessarily think that Foehn was right tended to say that you know, split the difference almost. I think Matt Singh had a paper out on with Populist saying that actually the vote was probably closer to the polls were probably closer to the Foehn polls than the online polls.
Yeah, it was like six out of the 8 point gap or something.
And you know, given obviously you know Matt's astonishing work on the general election, you know, that's something I paid very close attention to. But it wasn't it wasn't because of Matt, or it wasn't because of anything like that. I just thought that given the full weight of the government machine and David Cameron, who had only recently won re-election, being behind a Remain vote, and it's given the feeling that you know, okay, I suppose in hindsight it wasn't true that all of the all of the business community, all of the big players seemed to be behind that. I felt that when push came to shove, uncertainty would lead to people swinging behind the Remain vote. But of course, that's not what happened. That's not what happened at all. Whereas, you know, as I said with Trump, I think that, yeah, still incredibly surprising. I mean, Leo, we were together, weren't we? That blue wall came down, if you like. We recorded the podcast shortly after. I don't think, I certainly wasn't predicting that before the race, but I think you could see, I think, in the aftermath of Brexit, it felt more likely. I guess maybe there's an order bias where, you know, because Brexit happens, Trump felt like it was... it's 2016, isn't it? This is going to happen as well. But I mean, what did you think, Leo? I mean,
right. So I get that point of sort of Brexit made Trump feel psychologically possible. I think that realistically, sort of on the day before both of them, I probably had thought that Brexit was more likely than I did on the day before Trump. And partly I know that because on the day before, on polling day, I took 8-1 on Brexit. But I didn't take actually slightly longer odds for Trump. So I clearly was a bit more confident. I mean, if anything, I guess I kick myself about Brexit and about not reading the polls properly, I think. I think it's clear that with Brexit, I should have been more uncertain about the result because the polls were uncertain. And I think that was a mistake on my part. And of course, lots of other people as well. To be honest, I don't on Trump. I don't feel like I should have looked at the polls and come up with a different conclusion. I think, yeah, you know, I can, sure, with hindsight, it's possible to see where they went wrong. But I think with the knowledge I had at the time, Brexit, I think it's fair to say that I called that wrong. And, you know,
on the Trump vote? Is that because of the national vote share, essentially?
Yeah, and obviously there were limited polls in the states that turned out to be the swing states. So there wasn't enough information, particularly right in the last week or two. But yeah, I mean, smarter, better people who were looking at polls more closely than I was were saying before Trump, you know, this is looking pretty comfortable for Clinton. Mm-hmm. I don't think there was so much that pre-Brexit. I mean, John Curtis, I seem to remember, was saying this is right on a knife edge. And I guess I kind of discounted that. Mm-hmm. But I think there wasn't the same kind of information before the American election.
Yeah, I mean, in hindsight, with Trump, I feel like there was a piece of analysis that I think Nate Silver or one of the team in 538 did, which looked at the kind of that Rust Belt sort of vote share and how those polling averages were quite correlated with each other. And I feel like the solid lead that Trump had in Ohio, I kind of wrote off as being a uniquely Ohio thing, whereas actually, a bit like in actually the 2015 general election here, if this is what's happening in these places, mm-hmm. then there's every chance that this is also happening somewhere else. So the idea that Hillary Clinton had essentially had exactly the same margin as Obama or better in Wisconsin from, you know, whenever it was, meant that everybody assumed that Wisconsin was a lock. She then didn't visit Wisconsin. So, like, there's all sorts of, mm-hmm. you know, clearly lots of people felt like Wisconsin wasn't moving in the same direction, whereas actually it was moving in exactly the same direction.
I think in the primaries there was a big polling miss in Michigan where Bernie Sanders won against the odds. Now, obviously, you're polling a completely different audience there, but I do remember on 538 them mentioning that, you know, maybe Michigan polling has a habit of being...
I think the biggest thing with Michigan was, you know, I can't remember the exact statistic, but it's something like 60,000 fewer votes in Detroit, almost all of them, you know, by modelling, assumed to be African Americans. Like, that's what swings the state. Like, it's just that kind of level of detail of, like, a knowledge of African American turnout being down and therefore the entire state swinging, you know, that's the difference.
Yeah, exactly. And I just don't feel like that was information that was available to us at that level of nuance, which is why I sort of, to be honest, I look pretty skeptically on someone who says now, oh yeah, it was obvious and I called it as Trump and it was always going to be like, because I think, well, really, did you have that level of detail? Yeah. Did you really work out exactly how it was going to happen, or did you just get
lucky? Because you'd be deeply, deeply skeptical of someone that says in a poll of 800 likely voters in Michigan that, and I don't know the exact stat, that 80 or the 170 African Americans in the sample are looking less likely to turn out than last year. I mean, like, you or I would be like, you can't make that assumption.
Yeah, I mean, to have called Trump and actually genuinely called it, you had to have said Hillary Clinton's going to win the popular vote, but Donald Trump's going to break through the blue wall. So it's such a razor-thin margin that he's going to win the Electoral College. Yeah. I mean, let's move on. So I guess in such a seismic year, Leo, there's been winners and there's been losers. And one of our poll questions was who people thought the biggest winner of 2016 was, the biggest political winner, I think. What were some of the findings?
Well, the two big standout ones that people went for were Trump and Farage, and they were both quite far ahead of the others and quite close to each other. And it was interesting the reasons that people gave, that they were quite unified, quite similar reasons actually that people gave for the two of them, which is really sort of, obviously both of them achieved their goals. I mean, that's not surprising, but I think a lot of people kind of pointed out that they started the year with it really looking like they didn't have much chance. And they had a background of not doing things the way you normally are expected to do if you're going to win in politics. So neither of them had been in the centre of the political machine that they were trying to dominate, and obviously in quite different ways. But essentially a feeling that both of them sort of broke the rules. And I guess, and this is slightly more my own interpretation, that's about them riding the wave, or perhaps creating to an extent a kind of a popular surge that allowed them to work around the normal channels of winning elections. So very much dominated by them. A few people mentioned
who's the winner, Donald Trump being the winner. In that poll.
A few of them mentioned
exactly the same percentage as his popular vote share.
Good. Possibly relevant, but possibly completely trivial facts there, Rob. Thanks.
Well, you said Nigel Farage and Donald Trump were close to each other, which I thought was ironic as well, but anyway.
Thank you. So a few mentioned Corbyn obviously defeated his rivals. A few mentioned Sadiq, won against quite a racist campaign. A few mentioned Merkel, sort of standing now alone from a bunch of leaders, and there's obviously a photo that's circulating about that now. And a few mentioned Theresa May, and actually some of them kind of pointed out that at the start of the year, you would have looked at her and she might have looked at the year ahead and thought, you know, had no idea of where it was going. I think I don't quite agree with that. I think at the start of the year, she would have been fairly clear that there was quite a serious path to her becoming Prime Minister. And I don't think if she could... that looking back, that where she is now has come as a big surprise to her.
I would actually challenge that. It's very hard to go against Donald Trump as the biggest winner of 2016, given he's won the presidency from, I think someone mentions in the comments, I'll get the comment up in a moment, about, you know, he wouldn't have seen this on the 1st of January.
I'm sure he's also physically the biggest as well.
Well, yes, there is that. Less red wine for Rob, I think, in the second half of the show. No, but I mean, I think on Theresa May, I don't think... I think it was equally as unlikely at the time that she was going to end the year as Prime Minister than it was Donald Trump to be the President.
I mean, once he was the nominee, yeah, then perhaps.
Well, but we knew he was running. And, you know, I don't think anyone was sitting there this time last year going, I think Theresa May will be the next Prime Minister. In fact, I think she was... When we had our podcast with Damien McBride and we were talking about who potentially might profit from various scenarios that might happen in the EU referendum. I mean, there was a passing reference made to her, but she wasn't the person people were focusing on. They were focusing on George Osborne, of course, if David Cameron was to prevail, not necessarily this year, but people like Boris Johnson, and I think Michael Gove was the one to watch. I don't think Theresa May really was necessarily the obvious choice. And I suppose, look, the way she won the leadership was... I guess, you know, people sort of rallied around her as others sort of fell. And I would also just add very briefly that I think if you look at her political position now, not only has she become the Prime Minister, she's almost unassailable, it feels to me, at least in terms of the opinion polls and the position of the Labour Party when you factor everything in. Now, people may disagree on that. So I think she's gone from being Home Secretary and it's not clear what her future is to being all-conquering. Rob, you
want to... Well, no, so I suppose, without wanting to sound like a pedant, I think how we define winner is quite important here. And I think there's two things I'd say. One is that I don't think that, personally, that Nigel Farage did win on his own terms. Yes, obviously, secured a Leave vote in the referendum, but to a large extent, I feel like this has been somewhat underplayed in the subsequent weeks and months, and his own behaviour with Trump and so on sort of helped to sort of further this idea. But it was actually in spite of Farage, to I think quite a great extent. The campaign was run by, you know, Cummings and Hannan and, you know, Gove and Johnson and so on. And, you know, actually he was to a large extent frozen out of it, and quite deliberately so by many people. It was Carswell from the UKIP party who was actually on the, you know, the leadership of the campaign. And whilst obviously it got what he wanted, he's no longer leader. There is no guarantee. I mean, I think it's obviously more likely than not, but, you know, Brexit hasn't actually happened yet. You know, he isn't the British ambassador, nor is he any prospect of being a British ambassador to the States. He might well be able to make a fortune as a public affairs consultant in the future if he really does have a good relationship with Trump, but I don't think it's going to be under the auspices of the British government. And so, like, in terms of being a winner, I mean, yes, maybe his view of success is, you know, a Leave vote was all that he really wanted, but I have this slight sense that he hasn't actually sort of got the satisfaction.
It's pretty churlish, though, wouldn't it be, to describe him not as a winner when, you know, this is the thing that he's campaigned on. And actually, I mean, so there's an open end here from someone that I think is, you know, fair enough, explaining why they went for Farage. I won't read it all because it's quite long, but he campaigned for decades on the issue of huge importance to so many people across the country, despite the unfortunate lack of representation in the state courts, parliament and media, so on. A perfect finale to a youthful, charismatic Thatcherite's crusade. You know, I mean...
Yeah, I mean, it's true. Euroscepticism is something that's massively underrepresented in the British media.
Well, but you know, the point is, it was a lifelong crusade for him. It would be fairly churlish to... He doesn't have any authority positions.
There was a romantic image of him as, like, the leader of this crusade, whereas actually, to an extent, he, like, took it, you know, 90% of the way, and then it was someone else who carried the baton over the line. And I feel like he's, like, you know, doing... quite a good job actually of writing himself back into the leadership of that story in terms of, you know, the victory in June.
Well, but that's not trivial, right?
No, absolutely.
You know, whether or not he was actually there during the campaign, I mean, he got his goal and now he gets to position himself as the guy who...
There's one anonymous comment here that says Farage has gone from fringe meetings in pubs to changing the destiny of Europe.
But we're buying into Farage's own propaganda. Are we changing the destiny of Europe? I mean, seriously, do we really think that's the case? I don't know. I mean,
I think it's closer to the case than not, isn't it?
And what about this from Paul Peard, who says Farage made the EU referendum possible, Brexit made Trump's win possible? Do we buy that?
No.
Or do we think it's...
No, I don't buy the idea that there's much...
I struggle to see how many Rust Belt voters were voting
for Trump on the basis. He called himself Mr. Brexit. He wheeled out Nigel Farage. And
sure.
I'm not saying Farage caused Donald Trump.
Right, how many voters actually knew what Brexit was?
Yeah.
I mean...
The analogy is one that, you know, ironically enough, is drawn by elites, but not, I would suggest, the vast majority of voters concerned with changing the result. I mean, if you talk about one of Trump's campaign organisers said that, you know, fundamentally the result was driven by the results in four specific counties, three of them in Florida, one of them in Pennsylvania. And if you use that analogy, there are, like, whatever it is, 90,000 votes that shifted the election in Trump's favour in terms of winning the Electoral College. You'd have to show me a large proportion of those 90,000 voters that even, you know, could tell you who identify Nigel Farage in a lineup or tell you what the Brexit vote was or when it was or anything else. You know, surprisingly enough, the US in general pays so little attention to European politics in comparison with the other way around.
Mm. Shall we move on to biggest loser? So there's a few. It seems like quite a harsh sort of statement to suggest.
It's been a harsh year.
It's been a harsh year. I mean, have you got the numbers there?
Yeah. So I think perhaps unsurprisingly, in comparison with who the biggest winner was, Hillary Clinton was the biggest loser according to the survey. Just short of 45% suggesting Secretary of State Clinton. Former Prime Minister David Cameron, 33, just under 33%. And then what would personally be my choice, Zach Goldsmith, on 15% and third in terms of being the third biggest loser.
So you would say Zach Goldsmith was the biggest loser of the year?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at him at the start of the year, at the start of the year, Hillary Clinton still had to win a primary fight against Bernie Sanders, knew she was in a real rough fight, didn't know who the Republican nominee was, probably at that time was thinking privately, oh, I hope it's Donald Trump, we can really, really, fight, he'll be an easier opponent to beat. Dave Cameron, Prime Minister, sitting there imagining that he's going to negotiate the EU, but it's going to be hard, knows probably better than in retrospect everybody else gives credit that it's going to be hard and that it's entirely losable, and also that I think privately he probably had already then decided that he would resign if he lost it.
Of course he had.
Yeah.
I mean, this idea that he was ever not going to resign.
No, absolutely. Whereas Zach Goldsmith starts the year as the I can't remember exactly when he was confirmed as the mayoral nominee.
But he was always very going close. To get it.
He was always going to get it. There was no other serious contenders. Labour, demoralised after the previous election results, though obviously doing reasonably well in London. But Boris Johnson had won fairly commanding victory against Ken Livingstone. A very divided Labour Party in terms of who the nominee was going to be, trying to rally around the opponent. All looking good to be a kind of a bright, fresh-faced mayor in City Hall. Having seen Boris Johnson's pivot into government and all the rest of it, seeming like quite, this looking like quite a nice, handy route. A Cameroonie before his time, a new kind of Tory, sort of socially liberal, in tune with the times, all the rest of it. And then, how has he ended the year? Just a multi-millionaire.
Well, I would. Very good.
So I just kill it like that?
It was a great line, Rob. It was a great line. So I
agree with Bill Cook, who says David Cameron, he was nailed on in charge of the country as long as he wanted to stay, and unusually had positioned himself to go at a time he wanted, and then blew it. I mean, for me, I guess it's a trend with the... with the answers I'm suggesting, but
he kind of blown it already, right? I mean, this would be my argument.
But okay, so I guess my point, I agree with that, and I kind of disagree with Rob a bit, because I reckon, look, in 5 years' time, Clinton is probably going to have be going off and doing some great foundation thing.
I think Clinton's are done with foundations for a little while.
Okay, but she'll be doing good works, and she will be very highly regarded. This is slightly more controversial, but I reckon it's not going to be that long before Goldsmith manages to reinvent himself. He'll come out as a climate change campaigner or something. He will... this year will... I don't know whether or not he'll ever sort of say he was embarrassed and ashamed of the racist campaign. I don't know, but, he will somehow manage to reinvent himself. I think Cameron is never going to be able to get over his legacy of the guy who called the referendum and lost it. I think that when people look back at him, what happened to him this year will be more of a negative definition of his life and career than it will be for any of the others.
Is there anybody we're missing, do you think, on the biggest loser? I'm looking through some of people's comments here. Jeb Bush is mentioned by Steve, a.k.a. Sandpit. Spent something like $150 million on coming almost last in three primaries. Potentially a bit harsh, but some truth in that.
Owen Smith, I see someone's mentioned. Interesting one. Probably has damaged his reputation, which I guess in a way is a bit of a surprise that you sort of started.
But people know who he is. Some people know who he is now that nobody knew who he was at the beginning of the
year. Right, but he could have been a kind of a rising star. Now he is the guy who ran a campaign that pretty much no one liked. I mean, to be honest, I didn't think it was as bad a campaign as it was made out to be. But no. Broadly, you know, the reviews of it seem to be that it was a disaster.
I mean, that's I agree with that. I think Owen Smith, there's a lot of sort of revisionism going on about his campaign, that he somehow ran some sort of terrible campaign and it was the wrong strategy and all the rest of it. I don't think anybody before Owen Smith challenged Jeremy Corbyn was saying you really need to attack Corbyn from the right and challenge his ideology versus and convince the members that they're
also,
wrong.
Some were, to be honest, but
well, yes, but anyone that
Dan Hodges would have said that.
So the idea, I find it hard to imagine the voter who was sitting there, like a marginal voter, going, well, I was thinking about voting for Owen Smith, but he seems like a bit of a dangerous lefty, so I'm going to vote for Corbyn. I mean, come on.
Yeah, but in fairness, there was a lot of argument of Corbyn supporters who just thought that he was lying to them, that he was saying, basically, I'm Corbyn but electable, and then elect me and I'm going to do all the Corbyn stuff, but I'm going to win elections, when really they thought he was a secret Blairite who was going to undo everything.
I mean, it was, yeah, it was...
And of course, the former is much more likely, is actually much more, much closer to the truth than the latter.
I mean, yes. The messaging was confused, certainly, but I just sort of feel that for whatever reason, whether it was always set in stone or whether it was the chicken coup, as I think Corbyn's supporters called it, that really rallied waverers behind him because of the way it was done. I mean, I don't know whether it was either of those things, but I just think the electorate
chicken coup is actually genuinely funny, just to be, you know, like, someone is quite rude sometimes about the Corbynistas, like the chicken coup.
Corbynistas,
like,
you've got the stamp of approval.
Yeah, no, it's a good gag.
But yeah, I think the electorate was probably
Dr. Owen came up with that.
Oh God, everyone's favourite. But no, I think the electorate was set in stone for Corbyn. I can't really see how anything else would have happened. I mean, there's another loser that's mentioned a couple of times. Not my words, of course, but the words of our listeners. George Osborne is mentioned a couple of times. One person who's left himself as anonymous, maybe that was a Conservative MP, has suggested that the Crown Prince was kicked out of office when all assumed he was our next Prime Minister. I suppose, you know, with a career so tied to David Cameron, it was inevitable, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I feel like in some ways, and obviously, like, want to be careful here because I don't want in any way to sound like I feel sorry for him, but I feel like in comparison with David Cameron, who was, to a greater extent, shall we say, the master of his own destiny or the architect of his own downfall, depending on how you look at it, like, Osborne sank in the same boat and wasn't really in any position to, well, arguably wasn't anywhere near in the same kind of position to change course in terms of, you know, he wasn't responsible for the renegotiations with Brussels. He wasn't really that responsible for, you know, the positioning or the, you know, the arguments and the messaging, I think. And if anything, I suspect he was told to keep his mouth shut, given that his personally, you know, personal ratings aren't hugely... weren't hugely effective in terms of driving a Remain vote in the campaign. You know, he was kind of used to wheel out a kind of, there is a boring, dry economic argument about why we shouldn't do this, and I'm the Chancellor and I'm making it. He was not in any way wheeled out to make a kind
some
of
his own side were...
emotional kind of plea for why the European project was worth, you know, saving, or why he was, as a fiscally conservative, fairly, you know, socially liberal kind of politician, in favour of it, isn't it?
I mean, there were things that, like, some people on the right didn't appreciate, such as the sort of emergency budget.
Yeah, the punishment budget.
And things like that. I mean, I'm not suggesting for a second that that changed the course of the referendum, but there were some people that were disproportionately annoyed
about it. They were ineffective, right?
The thing is, I reckon if at the start of 2016 you could have known that there was going to be a vote to leave, would you think Osborne's position at the end of the year would be any worse than it is now, or any better than it is now? I think it's sort of, he's roughly where you'd think, which is, you know, still a reasonably credible figure, disliked by the Remain side, by the Leave side, but still someone who's taken quite seriously and potentially has a career in front of
him. Well, that was going to be my next question.
Yeah, right.
Has he got a path back?
I sort of think he does. I mean, probably not anytime soon if leaving goes to plan. If leaving starts becoming a real disaster and looks like a crisis, then I think he's got quite a quick pass back. But
I'm the only one with experience of like the highest levels of government who has had nothing whatsoever to do with.
Yeah, well, precisely.
No.
Precisely. Yeah. But to be honest, even, I mean, if leaving proves to be actually not, you know, reasonably smooth, then I could still imagine. I mean, he says he wants to stay in Parliament. You know, given that he I guess, could have stood down. And he's I guess we have to take him at his word with that. I can't see why a prime minister wouldn't give him a job in 5 years or so. You know, he's obviously an extremely credible person.
Mm. Let's finish with our sort of defining moments of the year, rather than sort of events. Meaning, like, you know, rather than Brexit or, you know, Trump winning. I mean, moments that sort of stood in our minds. I mean, I think I wrestled with this before we did the podcast, and I think it's a tricky one to broach. But I think it's impossible to do a review of the year and not mention the murder of Jo Cox. I don't want to make any sort of political statement about that, her death, or say that it was somehow the most defining or the most important, I mean, or anything like that. But I just think it is important to acknowledge, because I think if we didn't, people would rightly criticise us for not doing that. But more importantly, I mean, it's a murder of an MP, which I think to a large extent, I don't necessarily mean this in a malicious way, I think has almost been not overlooked, but it's not been given the importance or the significance in airtime than it might have been because of all the other things that have gone. It's a very confused way of describing that. But I think because of the nature of it happening the week before the referendum vote, it kind of almost got overlooked or overwashed with events that followed a week later. And, you know, it's not something that happens very often. It is a real person with a real family that died. We shouldn't forget that, you know, politics does have consequences. You know, there are people out there, whether you want to say they're lone wolves or they're mentally ill or they're radicalised. I know there's a lot of arguments about the labels that we put on people and that sort of thing. But, I mean, the murder of MP is obviously a significant moment in history. I just wanted to broach that.
And I think it's more than that, because I think, I mean, I very briefly worked with Jo Cox and met her a few times. I made no claims whatsoever that I knew her and Brendan. But I think what's come out quite clearly is how heroic and noble her work as an MP was, and I think it's given a voice for people to see beyond the sort of I like my local MP but all others are just charlatans and in it for themselves. Mm. And I hope it's probably not visible in the polls, so perhaps this is a forlorn hope, but that it has slightly changed the narrative about what MPs are for and what they're trying to do.
Right. Well, I'd agree with all of that. Mm. And I suppose in terms of thinking about a defining moment, and this was certainly one or two viewers referenced this. I mean, I think far better way to think about it as a defining moment rather than her death is actually the amazing speech that Brendan Cox made in the wake of that, in terms of being both brave, but the dignity and also the content. I think to Leo's point about celebrating a life and also a sort of a vision of and about the importance of politics and its relevance to lots of people's lives. And I think if we're going to think about a defining moment, I'd far rather focus on that as a sort of a positive to come out of a tragedy rather than obviously the tragedy itself.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. I mean, other moments that I guess will be played on New Year's Eve or that people will focus on. I mean, Leo, what do you think?
That, I mean, there's been a lot of photos that have, I mean, maybe this is a Twitter thing, but have really, really encapsulated. I mean, of course, there's Farage and Trump in a lift, in a gold lift, or outside some doors looking gleeful.
That comes up a lot, as I think.
You know, I mean, it's sort of hard not to think of this year and think of that. I mean, a slightly obscure one that I really liked. Just after Boris Johnson's, what was it, resignation from the leadership race or announcement that he wasn't joining the leadership race, when BBC News, was it Norman Smith, was doing a piece to camera, and then someone, a journalist, I think it was Sam Coates from the Times, was leaving the room and did this astonished expression of just sort of, what has just happened, and was just, there's a still of this guy leaving the announcement with the 2016 face on of bloody hell. I think that was a good moment.
I suppose the defining moment, I think, as Rob alluded to on one of the earlier questions about winners, it sort of depends on how you kind of interpret it, I suppose. But the image that I think will live longest will probably be the Trump and Farage one. But I mean, the moment that really took me aback, I think, and again, it's probably because I found Brexit the most surprising of all, was David Cameron's resignation. That was the moment when he was giving his resignation speech outside Number 10, and his voice cracked, and he said how he said he loved the country and, you know, wanted to do well or something along those lines. Can't remember the exact words. Can't have been that defining. it was a moment where I thought, oh God, this is happening now, isn't it? This is really something that matters, because it doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, and what he's been Tory leader since, what was it, 2005? Is that right? There's a generation of people who are, you know, who are adults, who essentially won't have remembered the Tory Party pretty much without, or national politics without Cameron in charge, and suddenly this seismic stuff has come along and thrown him out, and it's sort of, you know, this is kind of the winds of change sort of thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Rob, any final thoughts from you in defining moments of the year? I mean, we've covered a lot of them, I guess, but
so I think maybe it's not defining exactly, but just the wonderful, wonderful, just like Shakespearean skullduggery of the whole sort of Gove piece, of him. Like, for me, it just said so much about kind of the difference between Conservative and Labour Party leadership contests. Sort of Michael Gove as a person who'd come out with all this stuff around expert, you know, the time for experts is over. That whole thing about his wife being written up as sort of Lady Macbeth in the preceding weeks, and the supposed leak of this, like,
the leaked email,
and all this stuff, and then sort of suddenly coming out, and then, yeah, as Leo said, like, the sort of, like, just the media just going absolutely amazing. It's just like, you couldn't make this stuff up, you know? He's announcing in an hour over here, and there's going to be nobody at Johnson's conference, and then Johnson coming out and saying he's not going to run, and all this stuff. So, you know, for the sort of sheer sort of political geek who loves that kind of thing, that 24-hour period was, I think, quite extraordinary, and to an extent, not necessarily a defining moment, but certainly a personal favourite.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't talk about 2016, of course, without taking the advantage of using one of these open ends that I think came from a gentleman called Luke, mentioning that his highlight of the year, or defining moment, is Wales reaching the Euro semi-final. So well done, Luke, I'm with you on that.
Yeah, that's what we, I think we file that under niche defining moments of 2016, but maybe not for the people of Wales. We're all very proud of Gareth, mainly only Gareth, being a Spurs fan. So I think we'll leave it there for this week's episode. I think that this may or may not be the last episode of Polling Matters this year. We'll see next week about whether or not we're going to be sort of dissecting some of the other poll findings in more detail. I know that lots of people are very keen to see who the PB poster of the year is. I think Screaming Eagles looks like a sort of front runner here. Lots of sycophantic votes for Mike Smithson, of course, as you might expect, although it's his website. But we need to crunch some of those numbers. There were
alternative words for Mike Smithson.
Actually, just before we finish, I just want to say a massive thanks. So, Kieran, you put in a question asking for Christmas messages to the team, and genuinely really, really thrilling to see a lot of people listening and saying that they're enjoying listening to it, and you know, saying that they want more of the same, and it really genuinely, it means a lot to us, and it's really, really nice to have those comments.
It's amazing to see that people actually do listen to this sometimes, though you don't necessarily realise. No, I absolutely echo that. It's great to see that people enjoy it, and that's the whole point of doing something like this, is that people listen to it. So, you know, big thanks to everyone for doing that. But yeah, it may or may not be the last episode of the year. We'll see next week. Otherwise, I might just do a post on political betting on some of the other findings. But Rob, any sort of closing remarks?
No, have a lovely Christmas, one and all.
I think Rob wants to tuck into the wine a bit more, Leo.
Look, this is. I mean, it's the year, or it's the 18 months when I learned to stop making predictions. So yeah, maybe next year we won't have any elections, so I won't have to, but or at least to be more humble in my predictions.
I think next year is the year that we predict the controversial thing happens and it doesn't, so I'm very wary about Le Pen.
Yeah, there's got to be a regression to the mean, right?
Yeah, maybe Marine Le Pen will be that. But big thanks, as ever, to Rob Vance and Leo Barassi for all their help this year and for their great insight on the show.
Well, thank you, Kieran, for hosting 88 episodes.
Two years of Polling Matters.
Two years of Polling Matters. Thanks very much. And yeah, thanks again, everyone that's took part in this week's survey and listens to the show. Hope you all have a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. And if we don't speak to you again before that, then we'll see you in the new year. Thanks for listening.